Hello, everybody, and welcome to Dry Dock episode 384. As it's a catch-up month this week, the questions are taken from guides 451 and 452 on the US Coast Guard cutter Taney and the USS Hartford, the Wednesday videos on Admiral Andrew Cunningham Part 4 and Kriegsmarine Wunderwaffe, and the Friday videos on the Streamlined Battleship and the C-Class Anti-Aircraft Cruisers. So let's get on with questions. Paladian asks, was there a particular reason why the cutter USCGC Taney was chosen for the role of amphibious command ship? Weren't there any better or more modern ships suited for the role? US decisions about what exactly they should turn into an amphibious command ship do seem to be a little bit scattershot at first, because you get ships like Taney and a few other ships in her size and weight class, including at least one other Coast Guard cutter. And then you have converted merchant ships and so forth, which are considerably larger, and a few that are somewhere in between. But when you take a little bit of a closer look, there is a common thread in all of these decisions. And that is that the baseline ship that they're converting isn't immediately needed on the front lines. Of course, Taney did have quite an important role doing escorts and so forth during most of World War II, but towards the end of the war, when she was pulled in for conversion, there were a lot of destroyer escorts that arguably could do the job a lot better. So, you know, therefore, not quite as pressing a need to have her on the front line. And then the other factor seems to be top weight and stability. As a Coast Guard vessel, she'd already proven that she actually had quite a lot of ability to, if you like, soak up additional top weight installations. You look at photos of her in the mid-war period where she's covered in guns, including quite a number of 5-inch guns, and it's very evident that the baseline design could have a lot of stuff installed on deck and above deck without becoming unstable. And obviously, you know, with something like a Liberty ship or something, similar things apply, because it's just a big empty cargo ship at its baseline, so there's a lot of carrying capacity. And so when you're talking about conversion to an amphibious command ship, you need admiral's staff or amphibious commander's staff, whatever they happen to be, flag quarters basically, along with staff quarters to go with them, planning, radio rooms, radio equipment, masts, etc., etc. So all of this is going to add a lot of top weight to the ship. And I think this is pretty much one of, if not the driving reasons, why they aren't going with converting many full-on warships into amphibious command ships, because, well, they've already used up most of their top weight and overall stability with weapons, and the only way you're going to install lots and lots and lots of additional equipment is by taking off a lot of that weaponry to save the weight, which obviously then means it's no longer a frontline warship. So if you have ships that aren't necessarily frontline warships with good stability margins that you can use, then why not use those? And ultimately, while yes, for a really, really, really big invasion, you probably want something that's in the tens of thousands of tons displacement range to supervise the whole thing, for more localized command, perhaps in accompaniment with one or more of the larger command ships, so perhaps to look after a specific beach or a subsector of an invasion, something the size of a Coast Guard cutter can, obviously, be made into something that can defend itself, but also coordinate everything that's necessary. And I think to a certain degree, although I don't think this was a primary consideration, but perhaps was a secondary or tertiary one, a big merchant vessel is in and of itself a target, because, you know, the Japanese pilots don't necessarily know what's in it, but it's probably valuable, whether it be troops, supplies, ammunition, or obviously command staff, so they're going to be going for it. Whereas something that looks like a small destroyer escort with a couple of extra masts sticking out, A, they might not notice it, and B, even if they do, there's probably stuff that looks a lot more attractive to go for, so it's probably a little bit more survivable in some ways. James Beeching asks, did she ever have a floatplane aboard, that is, Taney? Photos of Taney in her pre-World War II configuration are much harder to find than her World War II and post-World War II configurations. And obviously it's only in that pre-war configuration that she was set up to operate aircraft. However, Yes, she did at times operate aircraft and therefore have aircraft on board. Not all the time, but certainly at least some of the time. And although I wasn't able to find a specific picture with an aircraft, you know, all set up, wings out, either being recovered or prepared for launch or whatever, what I did manage to find is a number of records that point to people who were seaplane or floatplane pilots stationed aboard Taney. And of course, you don't put an aircraft pilot aboard a Coast Guard cutter unless there's an aircraft for them to fly and that their period of service corresponds to the period of service where Taney was set up to operate aircraft off of her aft deck. And so, yes, it appears that she did, at least at points, have aircraft on board and operate them. BK Zhong asks, how common is it for warships to sink in battle with sailors trapped in air pockets? I know this occurred at Pearl Harbor, but what about while out at sea? Sadly, in the era of ships which were compartmentalized with somewhat waterproof or watertight hatches and so forth, almost any ship that sank in that era where hatches had actually been closed up for action and there were a substantial number of casualties on board would have had at least some of the sailors almost certainly go down in the ship in an air pocket of some description. Unfortunately, that's just the tyranny of statistics. Obviously, some ships in the era sank with minimal to no casualties, so obviously then there wouldn't be someone trapped. But any ship that goes down with a fair number of people with it, yeah, there would have been some people in that circumstance. And that's simply because you don't need to flood the entire ship to make it sink. You just have to let in enough water for it to have negative buoyancy. I mean, submarines are a perfect example, when they're working properly, of you can go down underwater, obviously in a submarine, hopefully in a controlled manner, with a very large air pocket on board. And in one of those slightly weird twists of fate, if you did happen to go down on a ship and you were trapped in a compartment that had been sealed up, and thus you're trapped in this air pocket, how long you would survive was directly related to how deep the water was when the ship sank. And in some ways, I suppose it does sound a little bit twisted, because if your ship sinks in relatively shallow water and you're behind, you know, a thick bulkhead and a well-dogged hatch, you will probably suffer a fate similar to the Pearl Harbor survivors, where you'll run out of air or breathable air long before the water gets in, which is pretty grim. The reason I say it's both, you know, in some ways tragic and ironic is, of course, if you are trapped at that kind of depth, at least in some of those depths, there is the theoretical possibility of actually getting out, at least in terms of you aren't at a depth such that you'll immediately be crushed or you'll run out of air before you get to the surface. Of course, the flip side of that is that if you are trapped in a compartment in a ship, you're probably trapped deep enough within a ship that you'd probably lose your way just trying to get out of a wreck, which, yeah, that's the whole tragic ironic part. It's like, theoretically, if you could somehow get out of the ship in short order, you might be able to pop up to the surface. Now, admittedly, your chances of survival then on the surface may not be particularly great because you're still in the middle of the ocean, but it's still there. But, you know, you'll be probably knowing all that whilst waiting for either a slow leak or CO2 poisoning to take you. Whereas if you are in a ship that sinks in a very, very deep environment, you know, over the Marianas Trench, if you're at the Battle of Samar or somewhere equally, well, not equally deep, there's nothing equally deep as the Marianas Trench, but say, the middle of the Atlantic, somewhere that you're going several miles down, you at least won't have to wait that long because the pressure from the water around you will sooner or later probably make something break, and then a lot of high pressure water will flow in and that'll be the end in relatively short order. Usually probably not the ship's hull itself imploding. It'll probably be a hatch failure or something along those lines, or an internal bulkhead failure from an already flooded compartment rather than the ship's hull itself. Katana asks, could the Kriegsmarine have successfully disguised the true purpose of the Panzerschiff by significantly overstating their speed and armour and understating their range? I'd imagine that the justification would be something like, well, we can't rely on the Kiel Canal in wartime since it would almost certainly be bombed, and so these ships have to be able to get around Denmark and to the eastern side of Germany as quickly as possible in the event of war. Strictly speaking, there's nothing stopping them from trying, but naval architects would probably fairly quickly work out most of the ruse, especially if you significantly overdid it, because it would be fairly obvious that the ship's using diesels. So the first question would be, oh, okay, hang on a minute. How are you putting a diesel power plant, and why are you putting a diesel power plant in this ship and not getting long range? And equally, how are you getting high speed with a diesel power plant with just, you know, your one big funnel? These are immediate giveaways that you are not designing your ship for massively high speed, you know, mid to high 30s of knots or something like that. Also, obviously, people can just look at the ship as it toodles around, and if they notice, hey, this thing never seems to hit more than the high 20s of knots, whatever it's doing, people are again going to get quite suspicious about the claims of speed. Armor, that bit is easier, because obviously people just, they can see the outside of the armor plate, but they can't necessarily see how thick it is, so you can claim whatever degree of armor you like, although again, naval architects can then start calculating what your overall displacement is likely to be in those circumstances. But the single biggest issue you're going to face is the fact you've got a diesel-powered ship, which, as I said, is going to raise these two big issues of how are you not getting range and how are you magically somehow achieving such a speed, A, with a diesel, and B, with a diesel with just one funnel. And you'd have to keep a lot more things than just the specs of the ship secret, because you'd also have to keep the nature and size and scope of the power plant secret, which would mean roping in the actual diesel engine makers into the whole thing a lot sooner than when the ships are in service, because otherwise, even if you somehow managed to keep everything secret aboard the ship, someone could just look up the records of, oh, look, they put this many thousand shaft horsepower into the ship because they built this engine for it. Hang on a minute, these figures don't add up properly. Plus, look at that straight stem bow. Anyone who claims this ship is doing 33 plus knots without looking like a U-boat trying to dive is either mad or lying. Warrant Officer Will asks, you've mentioned previously that in fights between ships of the line, frigates would typically be ignored. I can't imagine this same courtesy being given to the Razade frigates, though. Did any Razade frigates ever find themselves unwittingly participating in a line battle, and how did that turn out for them? Well, in theory, even Razade frigates would be ignored because Razade frigates would be with the other frigates, i.e. not in the line of battle. So as long as they behaved as the other frigates did and kind of stayed out of the way except for towing and generally away from the main fight, they would be ignored in favour of much bigger prey. However, there's also the fact that Razade frigates, because of their size and capabilities, tended not to be present for the big main battles of the Age of Sail, simply because they were far, far, far more valuable overpowering enemy frigates in frigate engagements away from the main fleets. You know, for the main fleet, whether you have a 32-gunner, a 36-gunner, a 38-gunner, a 48-gunner, or whatever as one of your frigates, it doesn't really make much odds because they're not supposed to be engaging in the main fight. They're supposed to just be protecting themselves against other frigates and mostly doing scouting and signalling. Whereas in areas where there aren't the fleets and where your main opponent is just enemy frigates, obviously then suddenly the force multiplier of a Razade is much, much greater. And although there were a number of ships that were Razade, both in the Royal Navy and in the Marine Nationale, and one or two other ships in navies like the US Navy, in the grand scheme of how many ships there were in the Age of Sail, warships obviously, they still weren't a particularly common breed. And so looking through the various Razade ships, I could only actually come across two that were even present at all in major line engagements, both of which were actually French, the Diadème and the Brave. Is it Brave or Brave? I can't remember my high school French. Anyway, they were two French ships that had been Razade down into frigates. The Diadème, she was at the Glorious 1st of June, and the, I'm going to say Brave for the sake of argument, fought in a couple of battles in 1795 in and around the Bay of Biscay. However, in both cases, the Razés seem to have just stuck with the other frigates and therefore weren't engaged. So in the Biscay campaign, Brave is recorded as not having engaged in any major action. And although Diadem did have something to do with the Glorious 1st of June, that was towing a battered French ship around, which was just exactly the role of a regular frigate. On the British side of things, there were only, as far as I can tell, two Razés that engaged ships of the line at all in any significant way. Of course, most famous being the Indefatigable, which along with the Amazon took on the Droite de l'Homme. I've done a whole video about that. So obviously in that case, Indefatigable actually won, but that's not a fleet action. That's, you know, a Razé and a small frigate picking on a very heavily waterlogged and storm-tossed French third rate. And the other one was the Razé Anson, which went after the 84-gunner Foudroyant, which had was also actually, ironically enough, much like the Droite de l'Homme, rather storm-battered and operating under a minimal rig. But that engagement wasn't as successful, mostly because Foudroyant had rather sensibly anchored under the guns of a friendly shore fortress, and a bunch of other Allied ships, Spanish ships in this case, came out to also help. So after it became clear that there were far, far, far more guns than just Foudroyant, Anson had to break off the action. Almirante Brown asks, if HMS Shah had successfully torpedoed and sunk the Peruvian ironclad Huascar, how do you think that would have influenced the adoption of the torpedo by navies and the development of the tactical doctrine that underpinned its use? And conversely, how do you think the sinking or capture of HMS Shah by Huascar would have affected the Royal Navy's deployment of warships in distant foreign stations? That's actually a very interesting set of alternate possibilities. So I think in the first case, if Huascar had been hit and sunk by Shah's torpedo, well, the obvious thing would have been everybody would have been scrambling to get either torpedoes, period, or more torpedoes installed on pretty much any ship, since its efficacy would have been proven a lot sooner. And it might also drive a little bit more developmental work into making torpedoes bigger and faster somewhat sooner than historically. I don't think that the torpedo boat development particularly would be affected, because torpedo boats in that kind of time period and going forward are still very, very small, essentially coastal craft. And the fact that the torpedo works, well, that was kind of assumed in the development of the torpedo boat in the first place. It's just this is a nice data point for them. But on larger ships, not only would you see perhaps more developed torpedoes earlier and more torpedoes aboard said ships, but the tactical doctrine behind them you might see at least briefly, because I don't think it would actually practically work out, but you can certainly see someone coming up with the idea and maybe testing it a few times. You might see the idea of a torpedo cruiser arriving a little bit sooner, wherein somebody goes, well, you know what, kind of like how pre-dreadnoughts at one point were supposed to suppress and, you know, take the enemy out of being combat effective with their secondary and tertiary batteries and then use their heavy guns to finish them off. You might see somebody arguing, a lightly protected or unprotected ship at range with lots of guns can smother an enemy enough to make them combat ineffective and then close in and finish them off with torpedoes, and therefore they don't need to carry any big guns themselves. Or perhaps a small, fast cruiser, perhaps with a heavily armoured bow, can run in with a battery of torpedoes, obviously not underwater torpedoes because that'd be too soon for that, but perhaps a torpedoes launching off of the bow in the manner of chase guns. They can just run in, tank a few hits as they come in, and torpedo heavily armored ships and then go away. And that kind of solves the range and seaworthiness issues of torpedo boats. But I think just the way that ship design and torpedo design, for that matter, was changing so rapidly in the latter part of the 19th century would mean that that whole movement would be seen as, kind of looking back at it, it would be kind of a bit like Polyphemus and other ships. Again, an interesting diversion, but nothing that really caught on. Although then obviously the advent of torpedo-armed destroyers and so forth in the 20th century, you'd probably have people looking back and going, hey, look, this was that idea, you know, the one that we had 20, 30 years ago that was just a little bit ahead of its time. The flip side, of course, if Shah is crippled or destroyed or captured by Huascar, well, you do have to remember, as you can see in this image, in this painting, that you do have the Amethyst following on, who often gets forgotten, and the other ship that was involved in that fight. But let's assume for the sake of argument that this does happen. The main thing is actually going to be pretty much an even more accelerated version of what was something of the fallout of this battle in the first place. And that was people realizing that, hey, if the enemy has even, or potential enemies have even as much as a single heavily armored vessel, just sending out big, fast, unarmored ships to your foreign stations isn't necessarily going to work out. And historically, the fight between Shah and Amethyst versus Huascar was used as part of the drive in the Royal Navy towards the development of the armored cruiser. If Shah obviously suffers considerably more than she does historically, that's going to add even more weight to it. The irony, of course, at that point would have been that Shah had just relieved HMS Repulse, which at that point, that iteration of Repulse was an armored frigate. I'm not necessarily sure her armor would have been hugely successful against Huascar, but certainly if she was fighting at a similar range to Shah, at least the armored bits probably would have been okay. And of course, the armored frigate had died out because it wasn't a very efficient design at all, given the technology of the time. And this was one of the limitations on why the armored cruiser took a while to come about. Because while there were what are technically seen as early armored cruisers, the Nelson class, Shannon, the Russian attempts, the General Admiral and so forth, to which Nelson and Shannon were responses, the engine technology compared to the necessary armor thickness to be useful, plus the armament of the 1870s, didn't really work. You know, you could have a heavily armed ship, but it would be slow. And if you made it fast, the sacrifices you had to make essentially either meant it wasn't particularly armored, or the armor ended up in weird places like below the waterline because it was so narrow. So what you ended up with is obviously this pressure of, okay, but how can we have a fast, somewhat armored ship with some heavy guns? And then as primarily engine technology, but also to a degree compound armor develops, you then get the rise of the armored cruiser in the 1880s. As I said, you do get some proto-armored cruiser in the 1870s, but the real push that you see, where you see the recognizable armored cruiser developing, mostly happens in the 1880s. And the loss of Shah to whatever method would have vastly accelerated that, and also would have driven the idea more immediately that any foreign station needs at least one big heavily armored ship, obviously in the absence of an armored cruiser, presumably a second rate ironclad or something like that, just in case something like this happened again. BK Zhong asks, considering that the overriding concern for both Axis and Allied fleets in the Mediterranean tended to be enemy land-based air power, could the campaign have unfolded broadly the same way as historically if neither side had any capital ships in the theatre and had relied entirely on land-based air power for sea control? No, it wouldn't. It would actually have been a campaign that would have massively favoured the Italians, and later the Germans, I suppose, when they decided to join in. And that's on several grounds. Firstly, the reach of aircraft is obviously predicated on where they can base from, where their airfields are, and where particularly Allied air power could be exerted varied hugely in terms of land-based air power, depending on how the ground campaign in North Africa was going. Because at times, they could only exert air power from airfields in the middle of Egypt, and at other times, obviously, they'd advance considerably further west, and then it went back and forth. The Italians, at least, had kind of fixed bases in Sicily, Italy, etc., at least up until towards the end of the campaign, Plus, of course, their own bases in North Africa, which tended to wax and wane, similarly to the Allied ones, although obviously in the opposite direction. And, of course, the Allies had Malta. But there are still huge limitations on air power, period, whether it be land-based or carrier-based, during the Mediterranean campaign, particularly in terms of night. So if you have poor weather, low visibility, or indeed night, aircraft either can't fly, period, or even if they can fly, they're not going to see anything particularly useful outside of a very, very few aircraft with air-to-surface radar. And on top of that, of course, you also have the fact that at times, as kind of been pointed out in the ongoing Admiral Cunningham video series, at times land-based aircraft availability for the Allies in the Mediterranean theatre was verging on almost none. So obviously that would give the Axis air dominance. So things like interdicting the Italian convoys would be almost impossible, because with the distances involved for them to sail, they could simply sail in such a way that they passed within range of whatever small numbers of strike aircraft the Allies managed to base in Malta during the hours of darkness, thus making it much more difficult to find them in the first place and very difficult to attack them even if you knew where they were. And that would obviously improve Axis supply lines quite considerably. As we said, the Allies don't really have all that much in terms of air power generally. And in terms of the actual campaign at sea, the Italians had quite a few heavy cruisers to start with, and the Royal Navy, generally speaking, didn't. So this is why you see a number of engagements going back and forth of kind of, you know, light Royal Navy forces, light cruisers, run into Italian forces. The Italian forces might drop back to their heavy cruisers. The heavy cruisers then start chasing the British light cruisers. Then the British capital ships arrive and they start chasing the Italians again, or some variation thereof, usually involving the arrival of Italian capital ships along with heavy cruisers. If you don't have capital ships, so battleships or aircraft carriers involved, then unless the Royal Navy makes some incredibly different decisions about what ships they're basing in the Mediterranean, most of the surface engagements are going to resolve as British light cruisers and destroyers chase a bunch of light Italian ships. The Italian heavy cruisers, so the Trentos and the Zaras mostly, show up. The Royal Navy is forced to retreat. And that gives the Italians dominance of the sea, even in weathers where obviously aircraft aren't really flying. The only time the Royal Navy at that point has any kind of advantage is if they manage to pull off Matapan-style actions, where obviously they exploit the fact that they have radar and the Italians generally don't. But even then, you think of a Cape Matapan-style example, it was going to be far less decisive in terms of how quickly the whole thing is resolved if it's a bunch of 6-inch cruisers laying into some Italian heavy cruisers as compared to 15-inch guns doing so. Whereas historically, at least for the Allied side, having battleships allowed you to directly escort convoys with very heavy ships that had lots of anti-aircraft firepower and were very difficult to take out and were obviously very obvious targets. It allowed you to cover your lighter ships against the intervention of Italian heavy ships, including, as I said, heavy cruisers. It allowed you to do shore bombardment missions to try and harass the enemy land campaign. And even in engagements where the capital ships weren't present, like attacking Italian convoys, for example, with Force K and so forth, the existence of the capital ships allowed those operations to occur because, in part, the heavier Italian ships were on notice, you know, to try and deal with the occasional sailings of the British capital ships, or in the case of a lot of Italian cruisers, to screen their own battleships in the event of such an action. Whereas if neither side has battleships, well, what's to stop the Italians sending their cruisers out with their convoys and giving them much better protection? But more generally, the implied threat of Allied capital ships, which again, unlike aircraft, could operate in pretty much all weathers, meant that substantial portions of the Italian fleet, and for that matter, even the Regia Aeronautica, had to be pinned down kind of on notice in case the British did something. And of course, vice versa also applies. Whereas, you know, take away the capital ships, and as I said, the Italian fleet actually has a number of advantages. 34 Powers asks, would British battlecruisers have benefited from having 3-gun turrets instead of 2-gun turrets, since they had to lose a turret to fit in the extra machinery, roughly speaking, from battleship designs? And what effect would the 3-gun turret have had? And separately, is it possible to link rangefinders together, basically turning the ship into a giant rangefinder? Would this give greater accuracy, and was it ever tried? Yes, having a 3-gun turret or triple turret for British battlecruisers certainly would have helped. I mean, here's one I mocked up very quickly in Ultimate Admiral Dreadnoughts. And as you can see, what I've done is essentially eliminate Q turret and change the front two twins to triples. And then the aft twin has also become a triple. So I now have one more gun, which is quite nice, and one less magazine, which is even nicer. Especially considering that both Queen Mary and Lion appear to have taken very nasty hits to Q turret, and obviously in Queen Mary's case, that had rather fatal results. Now, how that would have changed weight is interesting, because yes, you're eliminating an entire turret, and yes, of course, you're eliminating an entire magazine, which allows you to compact your machinery spaces somewhat. But, of course, the magazines and the turrets and the barbettes for the triple turrets are individually heavier. Now, while it's not perfect, as a fast and loose comparison, you could look at the Nevada, because it's contemporary. The guns are only slightly larger than 13.5s that you'd find on British battlecruisers of, you know, Lion, Queen Mary, Princess Royal, etc. And she has both twins and triples on the same ship. Now, if we assume approximately similar weight proportions, it would suggest that 3 triples is going to be just ever so slightly heavier than 4 twins. But the savings that you'd make by compacting the Citadel would probably result in a net weight saving, which could, of course, be put into perhaps a little bit more armor. But I think for at least the British 13.5-inch battlecruisers, the two biggest effects, you know, setting aside the slightly thicker armor, would have just been without Q turret, there's a lot less to go wrong amidships. And also in things like the Dogger Bank Chase, where you have full broadsides, obviously that's an additional gun, but even when you don't have full broadsides, when you're chasing, you've got 6 guns instead of 4. At least when the angle's very fine. And there were triple turret designs considered for British ships, all the way back to the designs that were supposed to follow on from Dreadnought, you know, things like X4. Obviously, eventually you end up with the Bellerophons, but even with the 12-inch gun, triple turrets were under consideration. And when the Invincible class were being planned, again, triple turrets did come up in consideration at one point, and certainly also for the Indefatigables. And given the limitations of the cross-deck firing, one could even argue that perhaps an Invincible class that looked a little bit like a prototype Deutschland with just 2 triple 12-inch, one at each end, might, you know, practically have had about the same firepower as the 4 twin Invincibles, because, well, you've got pretty much guaranteed 6-gun broadside on all angles, whereas with the Invincibles as they were, yes, theoretically you had an 8-gun broadside on very limited angles, but practically speaking only really at very fine angles. Or if they could make it work and they really wanted more guns, then maybe 2 triples at each end and 1 amidships twin. And that still gives you your 8 guns with 1 less turret to worry about. And again, perhaps some weight savings there to help you get better armor protection and so forth. Now, as far as is it possible to link rangefinders to become a giant rangefinder, yes and no. You can't link rangefinders together quite the manner you described to get, oh, look, now I have a really, really, really big rangefinder, even though a several hundred foot long rangefinder, if you could make it rigid enough, would be hilariously good at estimating range. But what you can do is something similar to what, well, a lot of navies would do, but particularly the Italians in World War II, and actually the Germans, at least at times in World War I, at least according to their doctrine, they should be. And that's what you do is you have multiple rangefinders all across the ship, pretty much like you described. But then rather than turning them into a single giant rangefinder, what you do is you have all of those ranges all fed to your central fire control system. And instead of going, oh, okay, well, here you go, fire control computer, in your primitive electromechanical glory, have a dozen different inputs and watch the poor thing scream and die. What you instead do is take in, let's say, your dozen or half dozen or however many ranges and go, okay, well, these are all from the same ship. We know where they all are on the ship. So, and we know, roughly speaking, where the target is in terms of bearing. So you can then look at all of those values and go, okay, this one's an outlier, but all of these seem to agree, roughly. And then you can take an average of all the ones that agree. So let's say you have half a dozen and you go, right, well, four of our rangefinders are saying roughly the same range. One suggesting 1,000 yards short and the other suggesting 2,000 yards over the other four. Okay, so probably the one that's short and the one that's over are something's gone wrong with those, whether it's an observational error, a procedural error, or there's something physically wrong with the rangefinder. So we'll take those four readings that all roughly agree, we'll average them out, and we'll open fire based on that. And that actually does get you considerably better results, because obviously you're eliminating rogue data and then averaging out the stuff that is vaguely in agreement. The disadvantage to this is obviously rangefinders are quite expensive, so it increases the cost of the ship. And also where you can actually put really big accurate rangefinders is somewhat limited. So a certain amount of the data that you're getting is going to be from smaller, less valuable and less accurate rangefinders. And that introduces more complexity into trying to work out how much weight to put on each bit of data. Because, for example, if you have two main rangefinders and they're both suggesting, let's say, 17,200 and 17,400 yards, and then you have half a dozen smaller rangefinders that are perhaps normally for your secondary battery, and they're all suggesting 16,500 to 16,800 yards, well, then technically the majority of your rangefinder systems are suggesting around about 16,650 yards. But the bigger and theoretically more accurate ones are suggesting that the target is further away, but there are fewer of them. And then you have to make a judgment call of, okay, are we getting these shorter results simply because the smaller rangefinders are just inherently less accurate, especially at long distances? Or is there a major disconnect here and actually perhaps something's wrong with our two long-range rangefinders? And all of this complexity in a very pressurized environment where you're trying to work out who you should be shooting at rather quickly can lead to complications. Of course, by World War II, you're able to link all of this data and conduct averaging and even basic elimination of rogues much more easily using in part the fire control computer itself. And that's why you see more and more navies go in for it. At that point, the amount of data that you're drawing in is really dependent on how many rangefinders you have, hence why the Italians are kind of past masters at it. The man formerly known as Commenting Is What I Do asks, how much of a threat did the Luftwaffe actually pose to the Royal Navy? While you've mentioned before that Operation Sea Lion was completely out of the question as far as the Kriegsmarine was concerned, more aviation-based historians historically would argue that the Luftwaffe would be more than capable of driving off the Royal Navy from any German invasion force. What do you think of this? If the Luftwaffe had won the Battle of Britain and established air supremacy over the Channel and the island itself, would the Royal Navy be unable to stop a German landing, or is the home fleet too powerful to be stopped? I think the broader question of how much of a threat is the Luftwaffe to the Royal Navy is hugely contextual to what exactly is going on at the time. So in the specific scenario you mention of a theoretical Operation Sea Lion, there are a number of factors you have to, think about in this event. So firstly, in terms of what kind of threat can the Luftwaffe pose to the Royal Navy? Well, as we know, level bombing is basically an irrelevance. You might get lucky with one or two hits with the sheer number of targets involved, but you might as well write that off. It's certainly in the time of Operation Sea Lion being proposed, German aerial torpedoes are a bad joke. So again, you might get a few results, but realistically, probably not, which means essentially most of the actual viable German threat to the Royal Navy comes from dive bombing. And that, again, in that time period, mostly means Ju-87 Stukas and maybe the occasional Ju-88. And the thing about Stukas is they are hideously vulnerable if they are opposed. And just because the Luftwaffe has established somehow air supremacy over the channel, they're not going to have completely defeated the RAF. So this is one of the key things to take into account in this particular kind of scenario. If the Royal Navy is going pedal to the metal into the German invasion fleet, any and all remaining fleet air arm and RAF fighter craft are almost certainly going to be thrown in to that effort in an attempt to cover the Royal Navy. And that means that even if they are only contesting the skies, they will be breaking up, harassing, attacking German bomber formations. There's also the question of how many bomber sorties can the Germans come up with? What is the weather at the time? Because if you've got very low cloud cover, for example, which isn't exactly uncommon in the English Channel, that's going to hugely complicate things for the Germans because, well, dive bombers need to have altitude to dive. And if there's pretty solid cloud cover, they can't really find the targets very easily unless they go low. And if they go low, they're not high enough to do proper dive bombing. And they're also much more vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire. And if they go up above the clouds to get the altitude, then, of course, they've got to try and hope that the target's going to be roughly where they remember it being. And there's a very good chance it might not be. Conversely, of course, if you have a wonderful, calm, sunny day, then the weather is much better for dive bombers. And that's just daytime weather. You know, the German invasion fleet would still be there at night, and the Royal Navy knows how to fight at night. So even if the weather was otherwise very good, the Navy could just go, okay, fine, we'll sail south during the day and we'll hit the kind of boundary in the southern North Sea where there's major threats from German Stuka attacks. As dusk falls, we'll get to the invasion beaches in the middle of the night. And, well, yeah, you ain't getting Stuka attacks at 1 o'clock in the morning. And then, of course, there's the context of what exactly are they doing? Because they're obviously, I mean, obviously, if you take a 1,000, 2,000-pound bomb hit to the engine room as a destroyer, there's not a huge amount you're going to be doing after that other than sitting there and gradually sinking. However, in the event of a larger ship being hit with a damaging hit or gradually accumulating damage or a destroyer being hit in an area that isn't immediately fatal, obviously in the course of a normal campaign, that ship would go, okay, my fighting capability is impaired. I can't take much more of that. I need to withdraw, ideally undercover, and head back for repairs. If there's a massive German invasion convoy currently either attempting to land troops or actually landing troops on the British south coast, well, apart from the fact that's generally a terrible idea, but more on that in a separate video, at that point, the Royal Navy captains aren't going to be thinking, oh, I have been damaged. Clearly, I must withdraw to fight another day. They'll just be going, ah, I have been damaged. Clearly, my next best thing is either to find the biggest German target in the area and ram them, or find a lot of smaller German targets nearby and ram them, and either go down with guns firing, or, heck, if they're going to land on the beach, I'm landing on the beach as well, and put their ship ashore, either on or right next to the invasion beach, and go, okay, Luftwaffe, try and sink me now. I'm already sunk. Also, there's a lot of German landing ships around here and my guns still work. And finally, of course, there's the concentration of shipping, because the Luftwaffe being able to go after, you know, half a dozen Royal Navy ships at sea with a degree of success is one thing. The Royal Navy being able to go after several dozen Royal Navy ships or more, all grouped together, offering mutually supporting anti-aircraft fire, that's a very different matter. And believe it or not, the early Luftwaffe reports when it came to Royal Navy anti-aircraft gunnery, they were actually quite impressed and mildly scared about Royal Navy air gunnery, which might sound paradoxical to people who have grown up on the kind of the general gist of what people think of anti-aircraft gunnery performance in World War II. But at the time, from the German pilot's perspective in 39, 40, 41, even 42 for that matter, flying into a Royal Navy long-range anti-aircraft barrage where they weren't strictly aiming at specific aircraft, but they were going, right, the enemy air formation is going to pass through this block of space. We're going to fill this block of space with a whole bunch of time-fuse shells and hope that something hits. That was actually very, very worrying for the Luftwaffe, because, of course, they didn't know they're not being individually targeted. All they know is they're flying along with their squadron mates, and suddenly the sky all around them is full of anti-aircraft bursts, which is very disconcerting, because it means the enemy actually has a pretty decent idea of where you are and an ability to reach you, even if you're not maybe taking that many direct hits from 4-inch and 4.7-inch guns. There's still an awful lot of shrapnel and stuff going on around you. And of course, that can work to break up formations and unnerve pilots, even if the actual number of kills it scores is limited. So, yeah, can the Luftwaffe on its own stop a Royal Navy interference in Operation Sea Lion? Well, you can have scenarios ranging back and forth for what that looks like. You know, if it's a clear day, the Luftwaffe has absolute air supremacy. They've sent several hundred fighters over southern England to intercept any last-ditch RAF efforts, and the Royal Navy intervention is maybe a dozen ships spread out in a couple of formations that the Luftwaffe has got plenty of warning from because of U-boats. Sure, yeah, at that point, the Luftwaffe can stop the Royal Navy. But that's a very ideal scenario. You switch it to an ideal scenario for the Royal Navy, where perhaps they're passing the Thames estuary at 7 PM, completely undetected, or maybe they are detected, but they sunk the U-boat before it could report. And there's a couple of hundred RAF and Fleet Air Arm fighters preparing for a big surge the following morning, and they arrive in the early hours of the morning off the landing beaches with, let's say, 60 ships of varying sizes, right, with all their radar going. And then as dawn comes, those 200 or so fighters arrive to provide a few hours of air cover, perhaps in batches of 40 or 50 at a time. And there's a low cloud base that impedes aerial reconnaissance and dive bombing anyway. Again, that's an ideal scenario for the British, but in that scenario, the Sea Lion invasion convoy is getting completely wiped and there's practically nothing the Luftwaffe is going to be able to do to stop them. Slow Pixie asks, "Hello, Drac. In your video on plunging fire, near the end, you mentioned that 3 or 4 inch deck armour would be adequate in an engagement that starts at 25,000 yards and closes in, and you know, that's towards the end of what we'd agree is pretty much the realistic distance for battleship engagements anyway. So what about Bismarck and Tirpitz? One of the main criticisms they face is their deck armour is thinner than Allied battleships and they're vulnerable to plunging fire. But given your recent statements on what Garsky and Doolin said in their latest book about Bismarck, that her deck could resist a 16-inch shell from Colorado at 20,000 meters, if I remember correctly, it seems to indicate she wasn't quite as vulnerable as it might appear at first glance and would have to fear deck penetration from 16-inch shells only at the opening stages of the battle. And when we consider that she has a much thicker upper belt and weather deck that would damage or slow down or initiate the fuse of any incoming shell, her deck protection doesn't look that bad. What do you think?" Well, there's a few things to bear in mind here. Firstly, of course, in the examples in the video, we're talking about the level of effective penetration, and we're assuming that the impact is happening with the ship pretty much horizontal. And as I said in the video, that level of effective penetration is, in theory, this is roughly when you should expect the armor to fail. If a shell underperforms, it'll be comfortably enough to protect you. But if the shell slightly overperforms, and of course, each shell is slightly different, both in terms of its durability and its impact velocity, then at that distance, you could end up with a complete failure, which is why most navies go for somewhat thicker deck armor than you would theoretically absolutely need, because, well, you don't want to lose your entire ship because you skimped on the deck armor slightly and one enemy shell overperformed. The other thing, of course, is, as I said, we were assuming for the sake of brevity in the video that the impact is happening with the ship dead level. Of course, ships aren't necessarily going to be dead level at the moment of impact. They're going to be pitching and they're going to be rolling. So in a worst case scenario, let's say the impact is taking place in the forward portion of the ship and the shell is coming in from a gun that's being fired from a ship that has something of a lead on the ship being targeted. So it's basically coming in towards the ship from roughly from the, maybe say 45 degrees off the bow. if the ship at the time of impact is going downwards, so it's plunging into a wave trough, and perhaps is also rolling somewhat to port, if we're assuming it's being engaged from the port side, then that changes the angle that the deck armor presents, reducing it, reducing the effective angle and increasing the angle close towards perpendicular, and that massively decreases the effectiveness of the armor. So let's say at 25,000 yards, if you have 4 inches of deck armor on a perfectly level hit, that will be fine. But in that scenario where you're kind of pitched down and rolled towards the shell impact, it's not going to be enough. So again, you need additional thickness. Now, as you said, Bismarck does have this upper belt and this relatively thick, what a lot of people call the bomb deck up top. And yes, that might damage or slow down an incoming shell. I mean, it's going to slow it down to a certain degree. The question is, by how much? Because you've got to remember that when it comes to battleship scale engagements and battleship armor, multiple layers of armor are actually less effective than their cumulative thickness would suggest. And when you get down to thinner elements, like 1 or 2 inches against a battleship size shell, you can also get into relatively minimal effects along with complete material failure, kind of like Hal pointed out that technically speaking, you're penetrating quite a bit of tinfoil by running a pencil along it near perpendicular, but the sheer thinness of that material will still lead to it failing, even though theoretically on paper it looks like it maybe shouldn't. So yes, overall, although Bismarck has a thinner armoured deck than most ships of the time, in theory, a shell either coming in through the upper belt or through the top deck might be somewhat slowed, and that might, either through slowing or damage or both, that might allow for the ship to then survive the impact with its armoured deck. It's very much might, which is not something you really want to have in your documentation when we're talking about something that is protecting your main machinery spaces in your magazines. And the other thing which you have to bear in mind when you talk about deck protection, if you look at this cross-section, is if you have a partial penetration, or even perhaps not a penetration at all, but an impact that is enough to cause significant spalling, and that spalling will be very hot, from the point of impact. Well, if you look at the King George V, for example, which these two are next to each other, so we can compare them. If you end up with a hit to King George V's deck armor that causes, let's say, spalling, that spall has to then travel down through multiple decks, and not just in terms of distance, but also in terms of the actual decks themselves, has to punch through all of that in order to reach something particularly vital like the magazines. Whereas due to the low-mounted nature of the armor deck on a Bismarck-type battleship, you can see if the deck armor actually rejects the incoming shell but still has that hot spalling coming off of it, if it's in the right place, that hot spalling is going straight into the magazines. And, well, I don't really need to tell you why that's a bad idea. So there are still certain weaknesses associated with Bismarck-style deck protection system that really aren't present in almost any other battleship at the time. And once again, I come back to basically the same point I keep making about Bismarck, which isn't that Bismarck is hilariously weak and vulnerable, although she does have some weaknesses that other battleships definitely don't. It's more that she has a degree of protection, which, yeah, again, in some cases better than other battleships, in other elements is worse than other battleships, but she does it with so much extra tonnage compared to those other battleships that it's a hilariously inefficient way of doing things. In my How Would I Redesign Bismarck video, for instance, I think I managed to shave something like 4,000 or 5,000 tons off of her just by reconfiguring the armor, giving exactly the same levels of protection, but in a more advanced way. Jeffrey Conley asks, America's first dreadnoughts of the South Carolina class can, in a way, be viewed as modified versions of the preceding Connecticut class pre-dreadnoughts, thanks to Congress. My question is, had the US Navy been able to get to have their first battle cruiser-dreadnought armored cruiser, do you believe it would have been based on the Pennsylvania class? And aside from having super-firing turrets, what other changes could you see to the ship in terms of speed, protection, and firepower? It depends when exactly they get them, because very broadly speaking, because there's a whole load of shenanigans going on both in public and behind the scenes in the US Navy in the latter part of the 1900s with regards to battle cruisers, including a whole movement to try and reclassify them for political purposes as a type of battleship, because then it means they can just keep building battleships and they don't have to bother responding to the battle cruiser specifically. But anyway, the three broad strokes of US battle cruiser ideas from, well, let's say during the 1900s period, is in 1904, the reason I've got this picture up, there's a proposal to essentially cancel and supersede or just succeed existing US armored cruiser designs with something that has four 12-inch guns, so very much like the Tsukuba class in Japan. So if those had gone ahead, in theory, those could have been enlarged Pennsylvanias. However, by the time actual battle cruisers enter service with the Invincibles, US thinking has moved quite significantly beyond adapting their existing armored cruiser hulls. So in roughly speaking 1907, there is a short-lived movement in the US Navy to basically build almost direct copies of the Invincibles, which are obviously a very different design to modifying the Pennsylvanias. And that seems to even go as far as having wing turrets, because bear in mind at this point the US really still isn't quite sold on the idea of turbines, and even though the Invincibles had turbines, they still needed their wing turrets. So they're not going to get away with super firing turrets at that point. And then that kind of dies off, as I said, because of all the internal shenanigans. And then I would say probably the first serious attempt or consideration to look at battle cruisers for the US Navy, as opposed to just, you know, some notions of let's copy the British, is right at the end of the 1900s in 1910, when a bunch of designs are presented, I think it's half a dozen or so, to the US Navy for consideration. But these are very, very different to both the British designs and to anything that the US has done before. If you want a very, very shorthand way of looking at them, they in some ways kind of resemble what would happen if you took a Wyoming class, deleted enough turrets down so that you just had four twin turrets, and replaced the space where you would have the magazines and so forth for the deleted turrets with machinery, thus allowing you to get up to just a little bit over 25 knots, because the armor is very similar, if not in places actually identical, to that on a Wyoming. So essentially they've just traded some turrets for speed on the general Wyoming hull, obviously with some tweaks to obviously allow for that speed to be reached as well. And this kind of follows the World War I US design trend, where at the time, the US is much, much, much more about armor than it is about speed. Because bear in mind, by 1910, you're already looking at the Lion under construction, and that thing's 28 knots plus. So the US is willing to trade off a fair bit of speed in exchange for significantly better protection. In fact, even more so than what the Germans are doing. Vokir asks, in the lead-up to D-Day, how much say did Eisenhower and other Army or Army Air Corps generals have in planning the naval portions of the operation? Now, obviously, again, caveat that it's an interface with land-based history, but from what I've seen looking at Operation Neptune, which is the naval element of Overlord, obviously Eisenhower is in overall command, so he's getting somewhat more of a say than any other Army or Army Air Corps generals. But more broadly, it seems to be in terms of mostly an exchange of requirements versus capabilities. So rather than Eisenhower and other army generals going, ah, yes, well, I want this ship here and that ship there and this ship over here, and and I think this particular class of ship could go there. I'm micromanaging something they don't really have a skill set for. It's more of a case of, we want to land X number of troops on this beach on this day. How many transports do we need for that? And can those be provided? And then following on from that, okay, well, if we're going to land that many transports, we need the mines cleared. We also need a certain level of shore bombardment support. And then the Navy or navies would come back and say, okay, well, we can provide you with this many ships, this many ships for fire support with this kind of calibers of guns, and this many minesweepers, and this is the schedule. And then Eisenhower would look over it, obviously with his other generals, and go, well, can we change this? Can we have a bit more firepower here? Do we need that many ships over there? Can they not go over here? And then the navies would come back and go, well, we can perhaps change the plan this way, but if you want this, then we're going to have to bring more ships in. And for that, we need, obviously, to call in higher authorizations and so forth like that. So it seems to me more a case of, here's what we want to do. How can you do this for us? And then an exchange back and forth to try and make sure that everybody's happy with what needs to happen. Nathaprong Hong Sharon asks, Miyoko and Takao get a lot of comments about breaking the treaty, but had the Japanese Navy done the same as what the Brits did to the counties, would they have been treaty compliant? And conversely, were post-refit counties that had the extra belt armour installed above the treaty limits? If so, would that make the Royal Navy a treaty breaker as well, since the plan from the start was to enter the war with above 10,000-ton cruisers? I know some of them entered World War II without that refit, but I can't see any reason other than the war started before they managed to do it to all of them. And also, did Japan really have a choice to refuse the London Naval Treaty? Because looking at it, it makes me feel like it's almost entirely for Britain's benefit and against what Japan wanted to do. The Royal Navy could get rid of its 13.5-inch armed ships, but keep all their 15- and 16-inch armed ships, while the Japanese were forced to give up Hiei and the US Navy had to keep Arkansas. Sure, Britain had to give up something too, but what exactly did Japan get from the treaty? I think it would be very difficult for the Japanese to make the, especially the Takao class, treaty compliant by doing something like with the counties, as I've said before, I suspect deliberately leaving off some of the belt armor, because, well, for one thing, an awful lot of the weight that the Japanese cruisers have, which is pushing them over the limits, is associated with top weight. Now, some of it is associated with a very large machinery plant that they need to get up to the speed that their requirements call for. But also, you know, there's an entire extra gun turret up there, which is adding to top weight. I mean, okay, both sets of cruisers, the counties and the Japanese ones, have torpedo launchers. Theoretically, maybe they could leave the torpedo launchers off. That's not going to save a huge amount of weight, though, if when you're trying to bring them down under the treaty limits. But if you just took off belt protection off of, say, a Takao, then, as I said, A, there'd still be quite a lot of weight up top, and I don't think you'd have saved enough to bring them under the treaty limits. But two, because you've got so much top weight, and then you're taking away weight that's lower down in the ship, you could cause even more stability problems than the Japanese ships already had. And the other problem, of course, is that if you do start doing something really radical up top, taking off various heavy weights like turrets, like, say, for example, if you completely failed to install the rear two turrets and maybe put a small flight deck on the back and essentially make a kind of a predecessor to Tone and Chikuma. And yeah, obviously you'd have to still include the barbettes, but you could call them like armored silos for holding bombs and fuel for the aircraft and that kind of thing. That in theory might save you enough weight to bring you down below the treaty limits, but you'd so hilariously unbalance the ship that either you'd end up very bow heavy and it'd become obvious that something's missing aft, or you'd have to put additional weight in aft anyway to keep everything on the level, at which point you're back up to the same weight problems. One of the advantages, of course, in not including something as substantial as a belt is it tends to run a good length of the ship and is roughly amidships. And so apart from direct buoyancy, it doesn't have that deleterious an effect on the ship overall as compared to removing point weights, especially towards the bow and the stern. Now, as far as if the post-refit counties were above the treaty limits, some of them were. So the counties came in somewhat below 10,000 tons, and the initial scope of refit that saw the basically the first wave, the Kents, have the extra belt armour installed, theoretically, they started off by going, well, we've got this much spare weight, so can we get the belt armour in on that? Now, as time went on, they did start to go, okay, well, we're going to allow a 300 ton over the treaty limit, so 10,300 total for the total sum of works. And that was based on somewhat spurious kind of, oh, I think everybody has probably agreed that we that, you know, with refits we can go 300 tons over, it should be fine, because modern necessities. That hadn't actually been agreed by anybody, at least in writing, but they kind of sort of justified it to themselves that way. So depending on exactly which county you're looking at, some of them would be a little bit over 10,000 tons come the start of World War II. Others, believe it or not, would actually still come in pretty much around or dead on 10,000 tons. Of course, once they started adding radar and more anti-aircraft guns and all that, they went well over that. As far as the London Naval Treaty goes, well, pretty much the argument you pointed out was an argument that was going on in the Japanese Navy at the time. Now, part of it was down to the fact that whether you did things by ship numbers or tonnage, the simple fact was at the time that the treaty had been signed, the Royal Navy had more big gun, really super big gunships than everybody else did. And so inevitably they were the ones, if you were going to start scrapping ships, obviously they could go, oh, we'll just scrap the older ones, and they were going to come out somewhat ahead on all of that. But the argument that won out, at least for the first London Naval Treaty in Japan, even though it didn't win out in the second, was essentially that, yes, it gave Britain a slightly greater advantage, but it meant that the gap between Japan's fleet and either the British or the American fleet was small enough that either by building very high quality ships or by doing a sudden surge of construction before the war or both, Japan could nominally just about afford to catch up. Whereas without being party to the treaty system, and thus the economies of the US and Britain being able to just build whatever they wanted, at that point, they would be able to get so far ahead of Japan that Japan physically couldn't catch up because of the limitations on its industry and how many ships they could build. So it was essentially, yeah, it's neither choice was particularly good from the Japanese Navy's perspective, but one of them, which was to join the treaty, they felt that it left them within shouting distance of being able to overhaul one of their target navies rather than just being left in the dust. Brian Smith asks, many times you've talked about American levels of anti-aircraft fire. Are there any other countries that would use as a similar comparison, such as German levels of over-engineering or British levels of this or French levels of that? Well, given that American levels of anti-aircraft fire kind of concentrates on World War II, if we were looking at purely World War II, then yeah, German levels of over-engineering would definitely be one. I think for World War II, French levels of sheer bad luck would probably be my candidate for poor old France, because there are so many things with the Marine Nationale where you can say they did this really, really good thing or this really impressive thing or they had this really spectacular opportunity, but, and then something relatively terribly unfortunate or spectacularly unlikely comes round to bite them, which obviates everything. And if there was anything you're going to pin on the British for a lot of World War II, I'd say, if anything, you'd probably say a British level of recklessness, because although obviously it doesn't necessarily always work out well for them, in almost all cases where you find a British captain subject to a decision point, which is the enemy is potentially considerably more powerful than I am, or the enemy is considerably more powerful than we thought they were in general, and we have the option to, you know, withdraw or fight a distant engagement or just keep going and attack. In the vast majority of cases, most British captains seem to just go, oh, okay, there's an update on the enemy's strength. Cool, thanks for telling me. Now, as I was saying, attack! You see that with, you know, something like Renown versus the two Scharnhorst. On paper, that should have been an engagement that Renown should have declined. And Renown's approach, that is, well, stuff that, I'm shooting at things until they stop shooting back. And it ends up being the Germans who end up running away from that one. Or the Battle of Barents Sea, you know, where, yes, you have several O-class destroyers. That's all right. I'll hold off Admiral Hipper and her escorts with just two. The rest of you stay with the convoy. And as I pointed out in that video, and spoiler alert in case you haven't watched it, yeah, Captain Sherbrooke was a tribal class captain. How could you possibly tell? Captain Oblivious asks, net cutters on submarines. Sometimes you see them, sometimes you don't. Was it simply that some had them and others didn't, or was it an import bolt-on addition should a submarine go on a mission that might need one? I've also heard mentioned that anti-submarine nets were somewhat ineffective, so did navies just realise they weren't necessary? So submarine net cutters are some variation on this lovely zigzag saw blade type thing you see in this case on an Italian submarine. And they were to an extent removable or able to be added to submarines. So there certainly is an element of that going. But also, obviously, as time goes on and sonar and passive sonar hydrophones become more and more advanced, as well, anyone with an understanding of hydrodynamics or indeed who has been a submariner will tell you, having something like that on the bow of your sub is going to generate a fair amount of flow noise. So not necessarily the wisest of things to equip if you're going to be hunted by an enemy with a decent sonar suite. It's also weight, it's also drag. But on top of all that, it's a case of, are you going to need it? Because if your submarine potentially might face anti-submarine nets on its way to and from its operational area, or indeed in its operational area, particularly if you're going on a coastal attack mission in an enemy harbour, then it might make sense to have a net cutter fitted. Whereas if you are, say, based in one of the French Atlantic coast ports and you're a U-boat and you're heading out into the mid-Atlantic, there's not going to be any anti-submarine nets between you and your targets, so there's just no reason to have it. Now, in terms of were anti-submarine nets themselves ineffective, it depends. There's a kind of a swings and roundabout situation in that sometimes they're more effective than others. A lot of it depends on what kind of anti-submarine net are you using, because just having a net doesn't necessarily make it an anti-submarine net. They can come in all sorts of weights and shapes and sizes and indeed materials, most of them being made out of steel. And obviously the shape and the size of the submarine also affects how useful they may or may not be, because a small, slow coastal sub, for instance, is going to have much harder time breaching a net than a large, fast underwater submarine with a lot of momentum behind it. But on top of that, it also depends of, are you just facing an anti-submarine net, or is there other defensive measures in place as well? You know, for example, a submarine might be able to punch through a net, but if that net is supported by a lot of buoys and the buoys are being monitored and someone says, hey, hang on, that, you know, two of those buoys suddenly dipped underwater for a bit while, you know, the net's being pulled down as the sub forces its way through. Or if there are sensors or small explosive charges attached to the nets, all of this makes going after the nets much less of a valid option for submarines, let alone obviously the chances of a net fouling the screws. So depending on exactly what kind of anti-submarine net and additional defences you're facing can make a huge difference as to whether or not that is an effective defence or not. And finally, Texas and LaShock asks, how many times were battleships actually sunk by aircraft versus how many times were carriers sunk by aircraft? I can think of five instances off the top of my head. Foresight, Prince Wales and Repulse, Yamato Musashi, and Hiei, all sunk while they were at sea and underway. This isn't counting ships in harbour and stationary like Pearl Harbor, Tirpitz, Taranto, etc. On the other hand, we have four carriers sunk by aircraft at Midway alone, considering Yorktown being sunk by a submarine, and still more through the rest of the Pacific War. So what's the actual ratio? So if we use your categorization of at sea and underway, because obviously a fair number of battleships were sunk in port by aircraft, or let's say battleships and battle cruisers, there were definitely quite a few sunk in port, and some of them were quite alert, but okay, they're not underway. Hiei, I'd say, is a little bit on the fence because she was put into pretty much a sinking condition, if but somewhat slowly, by the surface action. But she definitely was finished off and guaranteed to sink by aircraft. So let's allow that for the minute. So we've got Yamato Musashi, Prince of Wales, Repulse, and Hiei. You also, of course, have Roma, hit by air attack with Fritz X's. So that would make for a total of six gun capital ships sunk by aircraft while on the move. And then for carriers, as you mentioned at Midway, you've got Akagi, Kaga, Soryu, and Hiryu. Now, although obviously we all say they were sunk by aircraft because practically they were, technically speaking, a number of the Japanese carriers at Midway were finished off by their own side, but that was really just to expedite their sinking. So I'm going to use that as a qualifier for other carriers. Obviously, Yorktown theoretically was on her way to be salvaged when she was hit by a sub, so we'll allow that to not be included. So we've got four, and then going through the extensive list of Japanese aircraft carriers that were sunk in alphabetical order and not including the ones that were in harbour, Chitose is sunk by aircraft. And if we keep ourselves to just light and fleet carriers, not escort carriers, you're also looking at Hiyo, Ryujo, Shoho, Zuiho and Zuikaku. So that brings us up to 10. Hermes from the British is 11. I think you could arguably say Hornet, again, like the Japanese at Midway. She was actually scuttled, ironically enough, again, by Japanese destroyers, but she was pretty much a goner. So 12-ish, plus Lexington and Princeton from the US Navy. Again, excluding escort carriers, because there's no escort carrier equivalent for battleships. So that brings us up to 14. So the overall ratio would be 14 to 6, maybe 13 to 6 if you don't include Hornet for whatever reason, in terms of aircraft carriers sunk at sea by aircraft versus battleships sunk at sea by aircraft, well, and battle cruisers as well. And that brings us to an end for this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and I hope to see you in another video soon. Bye for now.